this bringing together the one point and the ekagata, the sense of if we just get lost in wandering thoughts, then we can be scattered all over the universe. I didn't think about Thailand or Australia, places far away. And your mind, the thinking process, just notice it's one thought, then conditions the next one. So association, you start thinking, and you think of Thailand, and then that word associates, that thought associates with something else. And so one can wander, just because the nature of thought is like that. And we're just noticing that thinking is a function that can be used skillfully, or one just can be lost in one's own thinking habits. That's where so much of the stress and depression, misery, human misery, comes from being a kind of victim of one's own thinking habits. Like poor people tend to imagine wealthy people are very happy because they don't have to think about the next meal or survival. They thought they can afford luxuries. But yet the problem is the same, isn't it, whether you're poor or rich. If you're a victim of your thoughts, then, you're stuck on that level. Just obsessive worry, depression, anxiety tend to take over our conscious experience of life. So in composing the mind in the present, we're not thinking about it anymore. We don't have to think the present and criticize and comment on the present moment, but learning to relax into the present, trust it, open, these kind of words, receptivity. Welcoming. And then you're using the sati sampajanya rather than thinking about analyzing the present moment, comparing it with memories of previous present moments, and it's ridiculous. Is this present moment as good as the previous present moment? You can get yourself into a real twist by trying to figure it all out. There's a trusting in direct experience. Now it's like this. So the suchness, the as-isness, the da-ta-da, this is just this way, it's like this. And so we open and we just are witnessing, accepting, welcoming, allowing this present moment to be like this. Even if it's unpleasant, you're allowing even unpleasantness to be what it is. Then I notice the sound of silence. And as I kind of rest in this resonating primal vibration, allowing it to be this way, there's awareness, consciousness, but also you're aware of non-thinking, because you don't have to think about it. You're not analyzing it or comparing it, but using it, resting in it, being it. So appreciate that, like non-thinking is like this. You know, so you're this sense of paying attention to it, because it's so easily not noticed or appreciated. It's overlooked. Just like space can never be consciously noticed, even though it's present here and now, because we're so utterly obsessed with the things in the space. So then using thinking, like thinking, if you're going to think, then use it as a pointer to this present moment. Like they use this, like self-inquiry or who am I kind of questions, as just as a way, if you're going to think, then inquire into this present moment. What is it like? What is it that knows this present moment? Not to get an answer, but just to sustain attention. An appreciation of just emptiness. This is like emptiness. Non-self. You're not a person in this present moment if you're just fully present. As is. So then you can just notice, note that anatta is like this, no self, non-self. So it's like you're really informing with wisdom now. You're using wisdom, just noticing the way it is. Then the self, or the ego, or sakkaya ditti, For this to arise, it's a matter of thinking, isn't it? After I'm Ajahn Sumedho and so forth, and then suddenly this Ajahn Sumedho arises in this present moment. I start thinking about myself, remembering my past or planning for the future, and all this, and that's something I'm creating in this present, this creation of somebody who has a past and who has a future. So that's, we're going to notice that the self or the Sakkaya Ditti is like this. It's something that arises and ceases, but the awareness has a continuity. When the Ajahn Sumedho ceases, there's still awareness. There's consciousness, awareness, still present. So if I get lost in the perception of I'm Ajahn Sumedho, then that starts the whole world going on that level. You know, being somebody with a past, having responsibilities, duties, feelings, emotional habits, a future that I have to plan for. And so the whole world of Ajahn Sumedho arises in that moment. If I'm not mindful, and if I really believe in this world as my reality, then it has its own momentum. It goes in cycles of that tend to perpetuate themselves. So noticing when there is no Ajahn Sumedho is an escape from that dreary world of becoming. So this is just like discerning. What I'm doing now is trying to guide you into using discernment to know the difference between self and non-self, or what the world is in terms of the reality of the world, rather than just clinging to a perception and forming assumptions about the world and the end of the world. Self and non-self. So you can kind of explore it and experiment with it. So you don't be afraid to become a person again. You know, we're not attacking personality or self. It's not a kind of annihilation of personality or self, but being able to develop an awareness about what self really is, so that we're not bound into that limitation. Because personality and self-view and all these are very limited, you know, they're habits of the mind. And no matter how much you try to improve yourself, it's still very limited. Because that's its nature, its limitation. attachment to thoughts, memories, identity with the body, identity with your emotional habits. So these are, you know, these are in themselves conditions that arise and cease. Their nature is limitation. So as long as you don't know the difference, then you, then there is a tremendous fear and anxiety around our life, because we're in some way, all the process of being born and dying is going on all the time. Always having to recreate ourselves as a person. If that's all we know, and we need approval all the time. We need security. We need all kinds of things that reinforce our personalities as being, I'm a good person, or I'm a likable, lovable person, or I'm worthwhile, or the fear of not being, of being useless, failure, despised, humiliated. So then the Buddha pointed to this, there is an escape from the conditioned. This word escape, interesting one, because we you know, saying somebody's an escapist is usually kind of a criticism, isn't it? They say, oh, he's just an escapist. And, oh, you're just trying to escape. Because our ideals, modern ways of thinking, are that escape is kind of a cowardly thing to do. But the Buddha encouraged escape. But in this sense of escape isn't running away out of fear. It's knowing things as they are. It's to awaken this, that we're liberated from these limitations. And if you explore this, you know, it took me years to really, not just because it's so easy to go back to being a personality, because that's what one is used to, operating in the world as a person, the personality. But it does, it gives a kind of an alertness, an attentiveness to our lives. And then we see, like, the monastic form and the Vinaya and all this. This is to help alertness to a kind of, it can be used for mindfulness rather than for another kind of self we create. Like, we can use Buddhism and Vinaya and all this just to create another kind of person. You know, I'm a Theravadan bhikkhu, and I'm keep the Vinaya, and I do this, and we can become quite identified with these conventions. And then, of course, it's still dukkha. No matter how strict and good you are and saintly and that, it's still suffering until you waken to the Dhamma, the way it is. So discerning is being able to know the difference. What is self and non-self? Now, I found why I so fond of the sound of silence because it, and I found it a very useful place to rest in, because the mind's empty, and the thinking process stops, mine does. It's natural, I don't create it, it's not, I have to kind of make it happen through some kind of manipulation of my mind. I just open, relax and open, and then I notice. Now, with emotions, like just dealing with thoughts is one thing, isn't it? The thinking process. Thinking is quite a rapid process. So you know, it's one word follows another. But then these perceptions can trigger off emotions. So we can feel, if we think in a positive way about love and goodness, truth and beauty, in inspired thoughts, we have emotional responses to those kind of thoughts. One can get very high on positive thinking. Or negative thinking, you can get very depressed. You know, grumbling, complaining, criticizing, all these, you know, the more you get stuck in these habits of like complaining or grumbling or resenting, not to mention, you know, hating and stronger kinds of negativity. It just boredom, doubt, blaming others, blaming yourself, then you sink into a realm of a kind of miserable realm, gray realm of despair. So the emotions have a lingering quality, isn't it? So thought can set off some emotional reaction, and then that reaction kind of hangs around. It doesn't just, you know, it doesn't, like thinking, come, arise and ceases immediately, but a thought just arises and it's gone. You know, where did it go? But then the lingering emotion is like this. So in noticing that which remains, the kind of lingering feeling of like anxiety, can be just a general feeling of doom, impending doom, or something bad is going to happen, or it's a kind of nebulous, negative state of anxiety can hang around, can linger. And then the more we try to get rid of it or resist it, or the more we tend to reinforce it, it becomes a very strong habit. So with awakened attention, discerning, then we're noticing just the feeling of, say, anxiety, of feeling something's not right, something's wrong, something's going to go wrong. And just by noticing this mood, this sense of this lingering emotional state, totally welcoming it, accepting it, Then I find by embracing it and welcoming it, and then I can actually, by not trying to get rid of it, but just allowing it to be this way, then it I'm aware of its presence, and then when it ceases, aware of its cessation. Because you feel a sense of relief when some emotional state has dropped away, when it's ceased, there's a sense of really a pleasant feeling of the end of suffering. Not absolute end of suffering, like suffering is ended forever, that's a desire again, but that particular thing is gone, like this. No suffering is like this. So this is like being patient, because with emotions is that we really resist and fight and our emotions. And we're frightened of them, or we don't like them, don't want these kind of lingering feelings. We want to be happy. Make me happy. Or like doubting, vicikicca is, this, I don't know what to do, this kind of ambivalence and insecurity that we create through thinking. What should I do? Should I do this or should I do that? Am I practicing rightly or am I not practicing properly? Or am I pure or impure? Or should I be a monk or not? What to do? Can I really? Is there any hope for me? Is doubting vicikicca is one of the fetters. But doubting also is a mental state that you can, just observe this state of, I don't know what to do. What's next? What's the answer to the question? Who am I? And so this, as you pay attention to this lingering sense of insecurity, not knowing, welcoming it again, or into welcoming, embracing. Because it's a kind of lingering habit. It hangs around. One can spend the whole day in kind of a state of anguish and doubt. What should I do? I don't know what to do. Like people that want to disrobe, really, some of them in the past used to, years they were anguishing over whether they should disrobe. how much you wanted to convince them, monastic life, that's for you, that's the way to go. Yeah, but maybe. You know, give them a pep talk. Yeah, oh, that's what I want to be, a monk forevermore. But maybe. Can you have a relationship and be enlightened? Do you have to be a monk or a nun, or can you be enlightened as a lay person? And so these are the, you know, this, if you keep trying to figure it out on that level, you know, you go from one, you know, you one day you want to be a monk, and the next day want to be a lay person. So, because the thinking mind and that, the doubting nature, is not really recognized, not accepted, not discerned. Like certainty, and there's an enormous desire for certitude in our personalities. We want security. It's so, you know, you can see modern, like Western Europe, is the ultimate in trying to provide ultimate security in every way, from cradle to grave, trying to create these democratic, capitalistic, secure systems, so that we, because insecurity is such a unpleasant emotion, not knowing what to do, not knowing the answer to the problem, not knowing who you are. So in discerning this, not knowing is like this. Don't know. And then you can just notice that sense of, that kind of anxiety maybe, or that feeling of uncertainty. What is it like? Awareness of it, embracing it, allowing uncertainty to be. Interesting to explore, like, opinions and views. You know, the more you develop this way of attention, the less you cling to views and opinions. Because I find this with my own experience. So like this paradoxical kind of koan of right but not true, true but not right. This is, you know, Lungpa Cha once gave me this as a kind of koan to explore. Because like one can have views that are right, you know, and so we come up with our, this is, you know, this is the right thing to do, and you should do this, and you should keep the moral precepts, and you should be generous and give dana, and you shouldn't be selfish. These are all, this is true, isn't it? And so, I mean, these are viewpoints. But then attachment to that, and attachment to a view, can make me insensitive. So I come at you, you know, in full flow of arrogance and authority, and say, you should keep the moral precepts, and you shouldn't be selfish, and you should dedicate your life to the Dhamma. And so then it's coming from, you know, a place of me holding on to my views about what you should do. And then what do you feel if I should do that to you? You might have utter devotion to me and think, whatever Ajahn Sumedho says is right. So then it might even inspire you. Some people get inspired by being told what they should do. Other people just feel averse, you know, 'cause they just feel, you know, they just hear the arrogance and the insensitivity and the behind this attachment to the view. So an awareness, isn't it? One can be aware. Why do we feel so resistant to advice that we know is very good? And why do we resist the, you know, teachers or parents or authority figures can give us very good advice, but we feel resistant to it or rebel against it. And we know it, and we know they're right, but we're also picking up the fact that they're coming from an attachment to a view. So see this in yourself also, how when we do this to each other, you know, how, what it feels like, how we might be right, you know. You know, what the way you're acting, the way you're behaving is not right. I don't, you know, you shouldn't be saying those things. You should be more sensitive and more considerate and more giving to the community. You shouldn't be so selfish. And we can agree, you know, in terms of the advice, but why do we still feel resistant to it? And then because this is my reflection anyway, attachment to these views means that something in me is not really understanding you at all, not interested, not open, not receptive, but merely wanting you to fit in to my viewpoint, because that's right, and I can become very self-righteous. This is one of the dangers in the holy life, when you're living with moral precepts and all these kind of high-minded, altruistic ideals. You can get full of yourself, full of self-righteousness, because you're attaching to very beautiful ideas and very moral attitudes. But notice that this attachment is the problem, isn't it? This attachment out of ignorance, of non-discerning, not opening, not really observing the way it is. So I used to have a lot of this. I mean, I'm an expert on righteous indignation. But when I listen to it, it's something I can't respect in myself anymore. I don't like that kind of feeling. It isn't. It's too limited. It's blinding. So then, by discerning the difference between attachment and non-attachment, so like welcoming is actually allowing something to be what it is, even something unpleasant or bad or evil. It's not coming at it with some kind of righteous command that it shouldn't be this way. It's allowing conditioned phenomena to be what it is. And then our relationship to it is non-attachment. When you allow something to be what it is, then you're not attaching to it anymore. You're not resisting or getting rid of it either. You're allowing things to flow according to their nature, to their karma. So it all kind of resolves in this present moment, this sense of awareness, relaxed attention, accepting, welcoming. So, like attachment and non-attachment, yeah. Upadana, tanha, upadana, desire, attachment, avicca, ignorance, conditions, desire, conditions, attachment, conditions, dukkha, suffering. It's not desire, is it? It's the problem, it's the attachment to it. So, like with desire, let's know what desire is also. Desire and desirelessness. Attachment and non-attachment. So what these words point to is just a simple imminent act of attention. Where the awareness, as you rest in awareness, and really appreciate and trust, then you begin to see that your discerning abilities are at their best. You can see the attachment and non-attachment, or desire and desirelessness, or self and non-self. So the unconditioned, the amata dhammas, non-self, is desireless, is non-attachment. So then we can attach to, I've got to get rid of desires and I shouldn't be attached to anything, and I've got to annihilate my personality. is the logic of that. When we reason it out, we get into annihilation. You know, I shouldn't have any desires, shouldn't have an ego, and I shouldn't be attached to anything. Then what is that, you know, holding to that view is the what I call annihilation. So it's not holding to a view about non-attachment, desirelessness, and no self, but knowing the difference, having this developing panya to know, discerning attachments like this, non-attachments like this. Self is like this, non-self is like this. And then just through that discerning, you see, you know, it's like, it's very simple. You know the path through not through holding to any views, but by that realization, the peace, the bliss of non-attachment, of non-self, of desirelessness. Not through trying to make yourself into somebody that doesn't have any desires and isn't attached to anything. That's impossible. But through discerning with satipanya, satisampachanya. That's why it's bhajyatang. To be experienced, you have to know this in a direct way for yourself. Now this is discerning, knowing the difference between the conditioned from the unconditioned, and it's this position we're in is a conscious entity, an interesting one, because each one of us is like a conscious point in the universe, isn't it? We're incarcerated in a physical body, which is conscious, experiencing consciousness. So, you know, the reality of this moment is that each one of us is a point of light, of consciousness in this universe. So, we're experiencing from this point here. And from this point, then it's the T.S. Eliot poem, to apprehend the point of intersection between timeless and time. It's like the point, this resonates as a kind of the reality of our human position. It's a point where we at this intersection, this moment now, here and now, time is like this, timelessness is like this. The point of intersection is here and now, this conscious moment. From this point here, you know, I can't experience this moment from where you are, but only from this point here. And so our discerning abilities work there, because you can discern it. Time can be self, desire, attachment. They're like this. You know, you know them. You're the butto, the knowing of them. The condition is like this. Self is like this. Time is like this. Attachment is this way. Desire, condition. And you know, you see anicca, dukkha, anatta, you know, it's all the three characteristics, that these all conditioned phenomena is impermanent, not self. And the unconditioned, nibbana, viraga, anatta, sunyata, these kind of words are like this. No, I mean this exploring that, this to be able to trust in your own insight into this. This is what I'm doing, is just pointing to this. I'm hoping that you aren't grasping anything I'm saying. and if you are, at least be aware of grasping Ajahn Sumedho's teachings is like this. This is where you have to trust yourself to know, and the unconditioned nibbana, non-self. Because I can talk about it endlessly in kind of, you know, you write poetry about it, but what, you know, it's bhajjitang wei tida po we knew he. One time somebody described, I read it in a book, I forget exactly where, who said it, but about nibbana being the experience of relief. And they're putting it into a more ordinary context, because oftentimes the word is a superlative, and how people use it nowadays, isn't it? It's a kind of blissful heavenly paradise, as it's generally popularly used. But in terms of the reality of it, it's not like a high state of bliss, but relief, this sense of non-attachment, of, you know, you're carrying the world on your back and you're just worn out, exhausted with carrying this heavy weight. Your whole life you've carried this burden on your back, and suddenly you put it down, and you suddenly what a relief, nibbana. it's that kind of, I find this relief of not being anybody. You know, not having to be anybody. or prove myself or justify my existence, or, you know, the whole self-view. Well, that's such a burden to carry around in life. To be so obsessed and concerned and worried about oneself as a personality is hard work, and it's tedious. And then putting the burden, I'm not destroying my personality, it's not trying to annihilate or attack it, but understand it and realize how to let go of the burden, not carry it on my back all the time. So non-self to me is, oh, it's a relief. Sometimes anatta can be kind of a fear, you know, you're going to, if I don't have any personality, there's going to be nothing left, and I'll just disappear into a void, a black hole of nothingness, and panic can take over, you know, what will happen if I'm not somebody, you know, I don't have any personality, and then we fear annihilation, isn't it? You fear, that's a big fear, when you think about anatta and trying to figure it out with rational thought. It sounds like an annihilation, like nihilism. But the reality of non-self is, this is how I experience it, is relief. A sense of being at ease, and relieved of that burden.